This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. Ahmet Ogut is a conceptual artist who comes from Turkey and is currently based in both Amsterdam and Berlin. He works across a broad range of media and has exhibited at, among others, the Venice Biennale and the Gwangju Biennale. He's among 10 international and Malaysian artists who are currently being shown at an exhibition called Scene at Wailing Contemporary in Kuala Lumpur. Ahmet is here with me today. How are you, Ahmet?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've been always studying art, but I started studying painting in high school already and bachelor. And after that, I continued my studies with art theory. But during my bachelor, I started doing my artworks, first artworks, conceptual artworks, I would say, and taking part in exhibitions, I think starting in 2002.
Back in Turkey still?
That was back in Turkey. I was living there until end of 2006. Then I moved to Amsterdam for a residency program that was for 2 years. And since then, I've been living in Europe between Amsterdam and Berlin.
It's interesting that you mentioned paintings because you work across such a wide range of mediums. Your work has included installation, performance, drawing, printed media, paintings, as you mentioned. So what exactly is your approach to art?
I mean, also radio. Last summer,
I did a
radio podcast for 20 days, which I never done before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every time it's another medium, of course, I am like just a beginner. I don't know how to use that medium very well, but I do collaborate with people who do spend a lot of time with that medium. And it's not like always about the idea of producing that kind of knowledge, and it's about respecting that knowledge that people choose to spend their life with, you know, in those mediums, and kind of through that knowledge bring in other kind of collaboration, you know, with ideas, and do something it is not normally possible to do alone, you know, for both sides. I see a lot of potential in every time I get into a situation that is completely unknown in terms of medium. So I know most have to make paintings and drawings, and this is one of the least medium that is appearing in my practice, because I could learn more when I involve other mediums.
So then in terms of the work you do, the definition of what is art changes, because not everyone would look at a podcast or a research project as art.
I mean, we need to challenge the definitions always. Within art, there are several definitions also that are made, you know, the type of art that we do. And that kind of creates exclusions and inclusions, but inclusions usually kind of limited to political ideological stance or sometimes the market and so on. Art market. But I even see a creative, conceptual, political possibility in the commercial market too. You know, so there is no hierarchy between those decision makings. Either you are running your space commercially or institutionally or supported by government or it's privately created foundation. In every type of institution, there is a moment that you need to create a kind of ethical policy and the pure, real reason that you do what you do. And I think that's kind of like a shared responsibility. And I think as far as I am trying to figure out always my work within the medium or within that moment, what kind of work project I'm doing, I always think the social conditions around it, you know, who I'm collaborating with, in which institutions, which people, and how that is done ethically. So it's not only figuring out a conceptual framework for it and getting exciting for an idea, but that idea should be necessary to produce. That project should be necessary to be done, and there should be some sort of urgency in it. And that's kind of a need that has not only come from myself, not some sort of meditative self-satisfying need, but more like everyone involved gets something out of it, and it has to be done because of that. There is no other even option. And that comes as a kind of challenge to everybody. So maybe it's an excuse to start working with me. It becomes a challenge, but a challenge is productive, has to be productive for everybody. So I try to think always around this kind of thinking.
I think it's quite clear hearing you talk and also looking at your work that most of your works engage with a lot of sociopolitical, sociocultural issues. Do you find yourself naturally drawn to these subjects?
Well, how can I not? How can we not? It is, for me, even absurd to think that we can exclude these kind of topics that are part of our daily life. You know, overall political structures, they are not that far away. We are agents of every decision-making that we are not aware that we are part of it. We are actually part of every decision-making, you know, even if it looks so far away or so larger scale. And that kind of agency is, I think, has to be recognized no matter what we do. Because the moment we produce something, that project or that product we did will be interacted. And the moment it's interacted, it becomes political and social. You know, it could be a ceramic vase or it could be a sculpture, very traditional one. It could be a very traditional paysage painting. No matter what it is, the moment it's being produced by us, it comes with that responsibility of social, you know, sharing and what it produces afterwards, you know, ownership, a lot of other issues involved. So we cannot isolate the artworks from the surrounding, and we should not. That's the way we keep them in museums, you know. That's the way they become different than just artifacts. Mm-hmm. Because artifacts comes with an unknown knowledge of time around it, people around it, and you just know it is old enough to be valued and kept in a storage, and it has this potential cultural value, surplus value, nobody identifies yet. But every other thing that is beyond, we could identify beyond an artifact, that comes with that kind of social environment, and it carries, carries the responsibility.
So tell me a little bit about the two works that you are exhibiting at the Scene exhibition.
Yeah, there's one very simple work, which was also kind of created a funny misunderstanding. It's a sign which says this area is under 23 hours surveillance, video surveillance, instead of 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So I just simply reproduced a sign that exists with the same kind of aesthetics, you know, only changing 24 to 23. First, I proposed this as a kind of intervention to an art fair to shut down, really, their security. And they really thought it's not a great idea for them to really do that, but no one would know which hour it is. Yeah. And then I didn't give up about the idea. I thought the rumor it produces is actually stronger than in real shutting down some sort of security. It's like it's actually what is happening around us, especially now. When I did it was 2009. And now we can see how the surveillance became more and more part of daily life in many levels. So I thought, okay, as a plate, as a sign, installing this in public space, it already has this power of rumor, which happened. So it was, I sold the piece in the US to a sculpture garden, which is basically a park, public park, and they hang it on a tree as a sculpture. They got the piece as a sculpture. And some people saw it, and they saw it was a security failure. So they posted it on an internet website without knowing it's an artwork. Saying this is like fail.com or something, and all this, all those kind of failure signs, and you know, and that it was shared by a lot of people not knowing it's an artwork.
Yeah.
So I like the potential that had in it, and it's still circulated around it, so we will have it that way here. And the second piece is very fresh and new piece. It's called The Missing Tea. And The Missing Tea is kind of, it was about a very heavy subject, like something also quite dangerous to talk about. And I wanted to find a way. I was in a short residency in Mexico, in Tulum. And I wanted to find a way to talk about the things that nobody can talk about. It was, well, I didn't have to search around so much. So the time I arrived there was two things happening. One was the sign of the town, little town. When you enter to the beach road, you see the name of the town is there. This was done by municipality, a monument, municipality aesthetics. The letter T was missing. Okay. So it was not Tulum, but Ulum. and no one even cared to fix it for many, many months mm-hmm. until I arrived. So my first intuition was like to fix that, to bring the tea back, find the tea and bring it back. But travel the tea first. So I went there, I found the original tea. It was just lying on the ground. No one even picked it up and put it up. So I took the tea bring that to the beach where most of the locals have no access. They live a little bit outside. There is a village, the town is half an hour, at least 40 minutes outside. And they cannot just come to the beach without having reasons, like if they are not working there and so on. So I brought the tea there, and together with four former police officers, they just got fired because they went on strike, around 110 of them, because they were not actually paid at all, or they didn't get any equipment, and no money that was actually paid to them quite a long time. But although there was a lot of funds arriving, so they were protesting that they were forced to sign papers that they receive all this equipment and payment and health insurance, but they never did. So they went on strike, and as a result, all of them were fired. So I got in touch with four of them, and we did an interview with them. And they still had their uniforms because they paid for it themselves. It was quite extreme situation that they were in. That's like, it's almost surreal. Anyway, so they became like policemen on strike that are fired, and then we interviewed them in the beach also, bring them there also, a kind of like an operation it was. And so that's what you see. They appear with the tea, the lost tea, and the lost tea was introduced by a guide. And the guide explains that it's actually a European name, European misunderstanding. When Europeans arrived to the town, they thought Tulum is the name, but actually it was in local language. It means this is my land, you know, get out of it. Tulum means this is my land.
Right.
But they just thought, oh, this is the name. So that story is a little bit there. And then in the end, I returned the tea.
So that's a huge story behind the missing tea.
Yeah, that's all them. Also, I put Mayan language as an voiceover because it was less dangerous for them instead of speaking Spanish.
So this is a video installation?
It's a video installation, yeah.
Besides your work, the exhibition also features a range of Malaysian and international artists. This includes people like Roger Balan, Victoria Binstok, Anurendra Jagadeva. How do you situate your work within some of these others?
Well, you know, every time it gets a different kind of meaning. I mean, of course, it will get more local meaning together with Malaysian artists sharing the same space. And that's very important, I think, to appear in that context. And with the other international artists, I mean, I see there's very young generation to very old generation together being exhibiting, from very simple photography to, you know, very technological forensic investigation kind of works. I like the simplicity most of the time. My work is mostly conceptual and less technological, but it's very important to be between, you know, black and white photography to that kind of investigative practice. And that's why I thought it's going to bring a new kind of reading for my work as well.
I'm speaking to artist Ahmed Ogut, whose works are being exhibited at Wailing Contemporary from the 3rd of May to the 1st of July. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Front Row on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. I'm speaking to Ahmed Ogut, who is a Kurdish conceptual artist, and his works are among others that are currently being shown at an exhibition called Seen by Wailing Contemporary. And Ahmed is telling us a little bit about the theme of the show and his works that are being shown there. Ahmed, the theme of the exhibition itself, which is called Seen, is mostly about surveillance and the idea of being watched in today's world. How do these themes resonate with you in particular?
I mean, I've been interested with the themes more like a naive way, you know, when I started doing those early work. I knew it was becoming more and more visible. And nowadays, some of the other works in the show, I think, also deal with that more advanced technological approach to that. There is even a new kind of artistic practice that has been developed, you know, people who have the knowledge almost like, or collaborating with hackers even, or people who have those kind of software knowledge to reverse. Because what happens, I think, with the survey, there was a lot of innovative ideas by artists, and then this was taken by maybe hackers or software developers or startup people and so on. And so they were innovative inputs, ideas. And then, of course, usually governments, they are normally slow. They were the first ones to adapt that, recruit these people sometimes, and really create this network of like really sophisticated surveillance systems that we don't know even they existed. You know, they were mostly maybe in military bases. They were used first and then used by governments. I mean, worldwide, the internet was a kind of emancipation project, and it was, you know, taken over by the government. So this process always happens. You know, whoever is the faster takes over the ownership. In the software world, normally when everything is right, someone develops a software and open software idea, you know, more horizontal. Somebody else can put input and develop it further. It's like a little bit like doing PhDs and then getting them together in an academic world. So that knowledge is supposed to build and empower each other, you know, that is produced by a lot of different individuals. Yeah. And they have really sophisticated systems in open software worlds. But of course, when somebody takes that and claims ownership, and that's government and states, and hires the most skilled people, and then they just go and they don't mind it ideologically, just get paid very well and sit in front of a computer and develop that even for them, for that kind of ownership, that becomes more problematic. So we have a lot of idealist artists and hackers that they try to sabotage this in a productive way, or take the ownership back to the people. But it's very important. This has to be constantly done. You can take it back and then it's taken back. So I can see that less creative governments becoming more creative. Although from outside they might not look that smart, but they become more creative. And we become less creative or slower. And that's very interesting that that's happening. And we should not let that happen, actually. I think the speed in that sense, I used to think always that idea of speed. You know, you could be in a country where there's a lot of censorship, but there's always time, a gap by the time the censorship arrives, you know?
Yes, so, but they're getting faster at it.
Yeah, it gets much faster because of new technologies.
And they learn from, governments learn from each other too.
Oh, they also learn from protesters, from people. They take street ideas, you know, ideas that were developed during protests in the streets, in the uprising, and then they just take it and develop it even more and then use it against for people also. So we have seen a lot of examples lately. There was a time there was a lot of uprising and people had so many ideas and it was kind of exciting. Social media was used for that. And now we see the opposite happening, you know, this kind of manipulation of news was kind of like, you know, at the university, at the schools, it was kind of like an idea, a playful idea. That could be, you know, some sort of artistic strategy. And then we see that artistic strategy turn into fake news and fake news turn into, again, some sort of counter use by the governments or by the other manipulators, you know.
With art having a sort of reputation of belonging in more elite circles or in galleries or museums, is art able to reclaim some of this power that you're talking about?
Yes, I believe in that. I mean, we can keep art that way, elite and not accessible, or it's not so much about the ownership. An art piece can be owned by a state or by a private owner, but it can be still very public, you know. It can be still public domain. It can be still widely shared. So it's not necessarily blocking that appreciation of an artist and investing in that. It's not necessarily, if both sides doesn't want that, and if the artist doesn't care, if the collector doesn't care, if the institution doesn't care, the real potential of the artwork, you can easily kill it. You know, a lot of avant-garde pieces, they had this destiny because, okay, they were kept and it was good. They could have been ephemeral things. But then the potential, I think every single artwork has this performative potential, even if they enter the very concrete collections. And they should not just end up sitting in storages. They could be always activated without changing the work. Maybe they meant something else in the times they were done in 60s, 70s, 80s, but they could have a completely fresh meaning also now. So I think it's not only about for artists as well or museums just putting things on display that already they were made, but rethinking them with inviting new artists and rethinking the collections, rethinking the institutions and their roles in times of crisis. But I would rather think that before the crisis arrive, because then you would be more ready. If you behave, the crisis will never happen or will never arrive, then you are not ready at all. Whatever strong institutions can disappear overnight.
What will Malaysian viewers and audiences be able to gain? How will they resonate with your particular pieces that are being shown?
You know, it looks far away. The group of policemen that was fired because they were because they had this corrupted government locally there in Mexico. That might sound far away or look far away, but there is a lot to learn from that. I think it's also very familiar. You know, it comes as no surprise when when the power is abused. So. You don't even know anymore. There are moments, what is the authority, who claims the authority and who executes the authority in public space. And that's kind of when the things becomes very, very dangerous, and this can happen anywhere in the world, and so it's very important to watch that and somehow pay attention to such shifts to be able to still have freedom in public space. I was in a demonstration the other day in Berlin and with my Iranian friends, and we were like, yeah, it's actually nostalgic to be in a demonstration that is completely peaceful. Maybe one day we do it again in our own countries. Peaceful demonstration, that's like a nostalgic concept.
I think one of your most well-known projects has actually been the Silent University. And this sort of crosses so many boundaries, from research project to education to activism to social work. Tell me a little bit about what the Silent University is.
So the idea was I could bring together three different kind of institutions to collaborate to start up the initial years. And have a coordinator. So three different institutions would be an art space, art museum, art gallery, contemporary art center, with community organization, NGO organization, and with educational organization, university, academy. Bring them together to collaborate, kind of force them to collaborate. And then we have lecturers, they are all undocumented. The consultants would be undocumented people. Maybe over the years they receive their papers and citizenships and so on. So they have the experience. They would be our consultants. And they will be also a little bit more public.
In UK, right?
We started in UK, yes. In London, with Tate and Delfina Foundation at the time. And UK one lasted around 3 years with institutions. With Tate, it was 1 year collaboration. With Delfina, we collaborated 3 years. Some other institutions involved, including also Oxford University later. It started as an idea, but in the art context. And because I was an artist, I was in a residency, and I was invited by a large institution. So this was the first impression. Although I knew this was going to be the first impression, I had to fight against it from the beginning. Against my own name being appearing there, against institutions' name being appearing there. How can you make something even happen that we are not okay the collaborators happen right. to appear first? And the name of Silent University should be first. But we can't even put the names of our lecturers first because it was dangerous for most of them. Then first initials or even their silhouettes should be first. And then it comes the institution and it comes me as an initiator. And the first group, most of them, they were undocumented, and by the end of 3 years, they were all they all had permits.
Ah.
So this kind of process have helped them make it faster, their applications, because they got involved in this education platform as lecturers, you know, not like as students.
Mm.
And they could lecture in any language they want, and that would be priority. And then we would figure out later. So students wouldn't be like passive people coming to a lecture in English, but they would have to also involve with skill and time exchange and find a way to get the knowledge that is offered in another language. And since then, it's still on in Stockholm, shortly after London, still actively happening in Germany, in Mülheim. There is an office, independent space, and collaboration between a few organizations there. So we managed to find a sustainable model in some places. And in some other places, it was more experimental. There will be a new branch opening soon. I mean, it really has to become more than a project, you know. And so still first year is like more like an art project, but it is an institution, it's an education platform, it actually offers an education model that has to improve all the other universities.
Mm. Well, thank you for joining me today, Ahmet.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting.
I've been speaking to artist Ahmet Ogut, who is one of the 10 artists being shown at an exhibition called Scene at Wailing Contemporary in Kuala Lumpur. The exhibition is on from the 3rd of May to the 1st of July. And for more information, visit wailing-gallery.com or Wailing Gallery's Facebook page. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Front Row segments, you can download the podcast on our BFM app, which is available on the App Store or Google Play. You've been listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.